On April 5th, 1958, in Henryville, Ohio, a human thumb was found in a can of beans from the Morgan Family Foods Company. Roughly 2 weeks later, on April 18th, a second thumb was discovered in another can of beans, this time in Blake Falls, Michigan. And over the next 10 and a half months, severed thumbs were found every other week all across the Midwest, always in a can of Morgan Family beans. Naturally, the cannery and staff were inspected, but no accidents had been reported during that time, and no employees were found to be short of any digits. Yet, somehow, 21 thumbs made it into 21 cans, 8 right, 13 lefts, and out of all of those, 5 sets of thumbs were identified since investigators were able to lift prints from each thumb. However, no victims were ever identified. But the really weird thing, and why we're so interested in further exploring this mystery on this episode of Once Every 2 Weeks, is that out of those 21 thumbs, 3 had matching fingerprints.
Once Every 2 Weeks is a look back at music from the 90s through a modern lens and nostalgic twinge. Hosted by two guys who have been friends since high school, join us, Tom and Mark, as we examine old hits, forgotten favorites, and overlooked gems as we dive into the music that got us through all the fun of those awesomely awkward, angst-filled teenage years, one album at a time. How's life, Mark?
Not too bad. How have you been?
You know, I was doing better until Christine went to a Diana Ross concert last night, and Diana Ross has been playing across my house now for like 15 hours.
Well, don't be discouraged, because there is hope on the horizon. If you hadn't heard, Matt Talbot's side band Centaur have officially announced they are working on their second album.
Really?
Yep. So after 22 years, we finally get a second Centaur album.
Nice. We'll get to hear the hum voice again.
I mean, it still may not come out for another year or two or 12.
At least we have something to look forward to in life.
Plus, when he made the announcement, he said that the album that they're working on, he sees as being the second part of a Centaur trilogy.
Oh, so he technically announced 2 albums.
Exactly.
That is very exciting. I am a big fan of Matt Talbot.
In the meantime, if you need something new to listen to hold you over, we just released a new 14-minute single from Columbia Jones, and he has a new album coming out at the end of March. So by the time we actually get around to putting this episode up, that will probably be out. So you can look for Songs in an Empty House by Columbia Jones to hold you over until we have new Centaur. But since we don't focus on new music on this podcast, I wanted to follow up and see if you'd had a chance to explore Buffalo Tom's extended catalog. And if so, what you thought?
I have not.
Okay.
I haven't really done a lot of music listening lately, to be honest.
It happens.
I've been working a lot. You know, these pesky jobs get in the way of fun things like listening to music and playing video games.
Understood.
Have you listened to more of the Buffalo Tom catalog lately?
I've heard samples of the latest single they put out, and so I'm getting excited for their new album, but that's been about it for me, other than the subject of this episode, of course. So let me ask you, what are we focusing on this episode?
Blink-182's Dude Ranch.
Excellent.
Let me set the stage.
Please do.
The year was 1992. The world was embracing line dancing to deal with their achy, breaky hearts. Middle school kids were having romantic trips around the roller rink, hand in hand to the smooth stylings of Boys to Men. Bunch of people were wearing backward pants while they jumped around for some weird reason. And while Tom and Mark were just two awkward 11-year-old boys, a way cooler Mark and a way cooler Tom were coming together to build a legendary punk band we all know as Blink-182 in a suburb of San Diego.
Way cooler nothing. That was the height of when young me had a killer mullet and rocked a solid cowboy look based on the fashion sensibilities of George and Garth. However, even with all that, I still never liked Billy Ray Cyrus.
I think you just made my point for me. But do you want to try to do a better intro, Mark?
Yeah, obviously. Blink-182, an American rock band, was formed in Poway, California, a suburb of San Diego, in 1992. The original members were Mark Hoppus on vocals and bass, Scott Rayner on drums, and some other guy with one of those generic and easily forgettable names on vocals and guitar.
Tom DeLonge. And that was meh.
Whatever. Although, to your credit, you did at least nail the vibe of the time period. Although, I never could get a girl to hold my hand at the roller rink.
Doesn't surprise me. Let's talk about Mark and Tom for a bit. We'll ignore Scott for now since he doesn't stick around.
But I love Scott.
Eh, too bad. I'll start with Hoppus.
No, you do the other one.
Which other one, Mark?
You know which one.
Okay, Tom DeLonge. He's an on-again, off-again Blink-182 guitarist. He was born in Poway, California on a sunny Saturday, December 13th, 1975, with temperatures ranging from 48 degrees to 69 degrees Fahrenheit.
What was the humidity point?
Didn't go that in depth.
I thought you were trying to be thorough here.
I am. I don't want to be accused of not being well-researched again.
Whatever.
So Tom grew up in the burbs of San Diego. He was one of three kids who, according to him, was originally going to be a firefighter. He was in the San Diego Cadet Program. When he was 11, he got a trumpet for Christmas, but his true passion became the guitar that he got for his birthday from a couple of his friends in sixth grade. It was beaten up, and depending on the interview you find, Tom has valued this at $20 or $30. He said this was his favorite gift he ever got. Quote, "It doesn't take much to change someone's life, but it's what made me who I am today." With that, Tom ditched his firefighter dream to do music because, as he said, "they yelled at me to do push-ups." Well, then rock and roll seemed better. We would not be where we are today with Blink-182 if it were not for underage drinking, because while in high school, Tom was expelled from Poway High School for showing up to a basketball game drunk, and he had to attend Rancho Bernardo High School for a semester. At Rancho Bernardo, he entered a Battle of the Bands competition.
Fun fact, the song he performed at that Battle of the Bands was called "Who's Gonna Shave Your Back Tonight?"
Now, I can't find information about how he did, but it was at the Battle of the Band where he met Scott Rayner, who performed as drummer for another band. They hit it off and wanted to start a band together. He also met a musician, Carrie Kay, and his girlfriend, Anne Hoppus. Anne introduced Tom to her brother, and the three bonded over music, skateboarding, and surfing. This original threesome was united, and after the band that would be called Duct Tape, Figure Eight, and Blink, eventually we had Blink 182.
So if I understand the moral of the story correctly, showing up to high school events inebriated leads to good things?
That's what it sounds like.
Mark Hoppus was born in 1972 in Ridgecrest, California. Following his parents' divorce, he was sent to live with his dad in Monterey when he was only 8 years old. His dad traveled a lot, and according to Mark, he lived by himself in the fifth grade, which I have to say, I wish I had lived by myself in Monterey when I was in fifth grade. That sounds pretty rad.
Right?
But it led him in middle school to get into skateboarding and punk music. So naturally, he was no longer a straight-laced kid, but rather a complete degenerate and probably a lot more fun as a person. From there, he moved to Fairfax, Virginia for high school, and it was then that he got his first bass guitar for Christmas, and he worked painting his father's house to buy an amp, and he taught himself to play imitating his favorite bands, which at first meant bands like The Cure, which ain't a bad band to pick to want to be like. However, at a point, he had a girlfriend who was much cooler than he was and said something to the effect of, "If you like early Cure's punkish stuff, you should check out The Descendants." And in an interview with SiriusXM in 2016, Mark tells the story. He says, "It blew my mind. That changed the trajectory of my life forever. They were like this punk rock Beach Boys. All the punk rock that I'd hear before that was really angry and political and not really my thing. I really liked the melody and the harmonies of The Descendants. You could sing along to it, and it was stuff that I cared about, like food and friends and hanging out with girls and being pissed at your parents."
Fun fact, Hoppus is even featured in the Descendants' 2013 documentary Filmage, saying, "As far as I'm concerned, they invented pop punk. That attitude and that musical sensibility, I won't say that I entirely ripped it off, but heavily influenced."
I'd agree with Mark on this point. And for anyone who doesn't know the Descendants and would try to give Green Day credit for pop punk, I'll simply point out that the Descendants put out four albums and a live record all before Green Day was even a band. And as much as I would really love to keep talking Descendants, that's not why we're here, so I'll bring it back to Blink. Talking about learning guitar, Mark said, "I'm self-taught. I used to listen to The Descendants and The Cure and Bad Religion and try and learn the songs. That's how I learned to play bass. And consequently, I don't have the best technique, but because I learned how to play bass guitar by listening to music, I also learned how to write songs that way. I think you would learn to paint by painting rather than reading books about painters or painting. And I think it's the same with music. You learn by doing and getting influence from other artists." He was so influenced by The Cure that at a point in high school, he even started to dress like Robert Smith.
Hey, like you and your date for multiple high school dances.
It was just one dance, and everyone's already seen the pictures. Although I did do it on more than one occasion as kind of an everyday look in high school just to piss off the APs. Which somewhere in my research, I came across him saying he did the same thing for pretty much the same reasons. Anyway, Mark played solo gigs and sang in a band called Pier 69, who mostly covered songs by The Cure. In 1988, he even recorded a live demo with another band called The Attic Children, and that was all Cure cover songs. Then he moved back to Southern California. He and two friends started a band called All Things, and they performed covers of The Descendants, Social Distortion, and Bad Religion, as well as some original punk songs. He went to California State University in San Marcos and got a job at a music store, returning to Ridgecrest on weekends to play with All Things. He hated college and eventually abandoned his dreams of becoming an English teacher to become a punk legend instead. Which leaves me questioning, who dreams of becoming an English teacher? I thought that was what you did only after giving up in life.
Sorry, Mrs. Queen, for Mark's awful take on your career.
I apologize for nothing.
Hoppus tried to impress DeLong, you know, like you spent most of our friendship trying to impress me. He jumped off of a streetlight and broke both of his ankles and ended up on crutches. At a very early point in the process of figuring out the band, Hoppus left because his girlfriend, who he was living with, was a hater and felt neglected and gave him an ultimatum, her or the band. And like a chump, he chose her. So for a very brief period, he was replaced by a dude named Cam. It's claimed that Hoppus saw the error of his ways and came back just in time to record a demo in Scott's bedroom, but I'm pretty sure he got dumped.
I never saw anything on that point about him being dumped, just that.
Oh, I'm just assuming based on my experience with Marks.
I hate you, Milkman Dan. Okay, now we can talk about the baby in the group, Scott William Rayner Jr. And I say baby because Rayner was a few years younger than the other two guys. He started drumming young and started his first band when he was 11. He later played that same Battle of the Bands at Rancho Bernardo, as Tom mentioned earlier. Scott's band was called The Necrophiliacs, and it was their frontman who introduced Scott to DeLong. Soon after that altercation of musical groups, that same necrophiliac frontman moved away, so it freed Scott up to start seeing other people musically. So he and DeLong started to jam, and they went through a few bassists before they began to play with Mark. And then, just as it seemed like things were going great and the band was building a fan base, Scott's family moved to the biggest little city in the world.
For a brief time, Scott was replaced by a friend of the band named Mike, but Scott remained dedicated, and the band saved up money and were able to fly Scott from Reno back to San Diego for shows. They managed to do this for a while before Scott did the responsible thing and dropped out of school to move back to SoCal for the band. Now, to his credit, he did still get his diploma by doing schoolwork on the road, because, once again, he was a baby. Of that time, he said, quote, "The summer I lived with Mark and his family was probably the greatest summer of my life so far. I left home at 17, came to San Diego, we bought a van, finished our first video. I had all kinds of dreams in my head, and they were coming true." Hoppus's manager at the music store where he worked fronted the band some money to record a demo, not in Scott's bedroom.
Fun fact, the music store Mark worked at was called The Warehouse and was a part of the chain that would become Warehouse Music, which is the same record store chain I worked at for a few years during the unpleasantness.
That demo, which is now known as Buddha, got them some success, and they started playing some bigger shows and touring. They signed, well, Hoppus signed, being the only adult in the band, with Cargo Records, and the band recorded Cheshire Cat, which they released in February of 1995.
Cheshire Cat was pretty successful for an independent band and got the attention of Rick DeVoe, a manager who would take on Blink-182. The guys were excited because DeVoe had managed Pennywise, NoFX, and The Offspring. They also caught the attention of Rick and Gene Bond, who owned the Tahoe Agency, who began booking shows for the band. M&M's, their first single from Cheshire Cat, got some radio play and was enough for Cargo to give them $10,000 to record a video with Darren Doan.
I have no idea.
Who had done music videos for MXPX and Pennywise. However, the video was rejected by MTV because that video ends in a gunfight with the band members all getting shot by the model actresses who were hired to play their girlfriends in the video, and MTV thought it was stupid. which perfectly illustrates another quote I have from Mark, saying, "People always hated Blink from day one. We were jokes. We didn't take ourselves seriously. We always had serious songs, but for the most part, people always wrote us off as just this joke band, even today, and we're grown men in our 40s.
This was the same time that the Irish band Blink learned about our friends, and instead of fighting the Irish, the band added the number 182 at the end.
Fun fact, that number was completely random and has no significance whatsoever. However, in Australia, they say 182 as 182.
That's interesting, but apparently everyone is wrong. Tom set the record straight on Twitter saying, it's actually Blink 182. People have all gotten it wrong for years. Sometimes this can happen with very complex, thoughtful, elevated art.
Huh. But considering that he doesn't even know how to pronounce his own last name, I think I'll stick with 182. Thank you very much.
You know, if there's one thing I would not use to describe early Blink 182, it would be thoughtful, elevated art.
Would you use that to describe later Blink 182?
Yeah, I would. Like, bored to death.
So you mean once DeLong left the band and they brought in the guy from Alkaline Trio?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I can get on board with that. I love me some Matt Skiba.
Cheshire Cat caught the eye of the LA Times, who did a generally positive review for the album. They booked the Good Time Tour in October of 95, on which Tom was arrested for underage drinking. Then after that run of the States, the tour had a leg in Australia, but the band was short on funds. Fortunately, their friends in Pennywise purchased plane tickets for them, and Blink 182 was able to finish the tour down under.
That brings us up to what we're covering in this episode. In 1996, after a record label bidding war between MCA, Interscope, and Epitaph, Blink 182 signed with MCA and were then all set to make Dude Ranch, which they recorded over 5 weeks from December of 96 through January of 97 at Big Fish Studios in Ensenada.
And they recorded with producer Mark Trombino, who is one of my favorite producers.
Mm-hmm.
He's done a lot of stuff with Jimmy World, with Rilo Kiley, Finch, Drive Like Jehu, whom Trombino was also the drummer for, plus Rocket from the Crypt, Silverstein, Something Corporate, Creeper Lagoon, Motion City Soundtrack, Knapsack, The Jealous Sound, and Mineral.
Fun fact, Mark was the first guest on a new podcast that Jim Adkins started during COVID.
Yeah, he was.
And talking to Jim, he said, "We worked with Trombino for our first major label album, and he's awesome. We worked with him because you guys had worked with him, and we love the way that your guys' albums sound."
Which at that time would have just been Static Prevails, since Clarity didn't come out until another 2 years after Dude Ranch.
Good call.
Mark Trombino claimed responsibility for testing the limits of Hoppus's voice. On MTV News in 2017, he explained, "I approached the project with knowledge of Cheshire Cat and familiarity with Mark's style, that sing-song talk singing. When I began working on Dude Ranch, my goal was to add some intensity to Mark's performance. I drove him until he reached the point of screaming."
I'm going to choose to interpret that as an admission that Trombino was the one who got the band sick right before going into the studio, as all members have talked about how they were ill during recording to the point that none of them felt like their voices were in a good place and singing was painful.
Art is hard.
So Blink 182 released Dude Ranch on June 17th of 1997, and by February of the following year, it had hit certified gold status, and by November of 99, it hit platinum. Dude Ranch spent 48 weeks on the Billboard Top 200, and the album peaked at number 67. And while it is an album that we both love, you don't have to just take our words for it. Trouser Press described Dude Ranch as smartly produced by Mark Trombino. Dude Ranch sharpens every aspect of the Blink attack and is a really good record. The playing is hermetically sealed tight, the melodies are plainly effective, matched to occasionally inventive chord progressions, and the words, when they're not simply vulgar, address the sensitive emotional issues and self-criticisms that define emo. Now, do you think they mean Midwest emo or post-hardcore DC emo?
Oh my gosh.
According to Stephen Thomas Erlewine of AllMusic, on their third album, Dude Ranch, Blink 182 follow in the same path as their first two, turning out 15 tracks of juvenile, adrenaline-fueled punk pop. Some listeners will find their potty humor somewhat irritating, but the group has written some surprisingly catchy hooks, which might win over skeptics. The songwriting is still a little uneven, but overall Dude Ranch is an improvement over their first album, Cheshire Cat.
A 5-star review from Punk News said, Cheshire Cat showed us a promising young band on the rise, and Dude Ranch not only turned heads, it broke necks. Tom DeLonge and Mark Hoppus were stellar. They played their hearts out, providing us with many tempo changes and start stops, not bad for only one guitar player. Blink utilized their dual vocalists and belted out 15 heart-filled anthems about girls, teenage life, and girls. Blink used such variants on all tracks so that you didn't get that I've heard this somewhere before.
German music magazine Visions gave Dude Ranch 4 out of 12, saying, Blink 182, Völlig belieber und Todling Viger, Sound von der Strange, Bidem der Kaufer und P. Plattenfirma, auf den McDonald's Effic. Setzen können, aus Gewohnheit frischt man so ziemlich alles. Demnach sicher als Nachwunschtag auf diversen Festivals herzulande sie bewundern.
In a 3-star review from Rolling Stone, they say, Blink-182 finally focused their sound with Dude Ranch. Guitarist Tom DeLonge plays the straight man, singing sturdily and deadpan, while the squeakier voice bassist Mark Hoppus bleats urgently about romance gone wrong. Drummer Scott Rayner, who was replaced by Travis Barker in 1998, sticks to double time, but his songwriter bandmates hang their old weepy and wedgy routine on shiny new hooks. And that's a review that I really can't take seriously, since they don't even know which vocals are Mark and which are the other guy.
WTF, mate.
If they had put that review out when Dude Ranch first dropped, or when they got their first advance copied for review, that would be one thing. But if they didn't write this review until after Scott had left the band, by that point they were big enough that they should have been able to easily figure it out.
Right, just a cursory search even.
Absolutely.
We had the internet by this time.
Yeah, that's just sloppy music journalism.
Air quotes. In a 2020 interview with 91X San Diego, Tom said all the bigwigs at their label were having a great time at the Dude Ranch launch party until the album actually started playing. And in less than a minute into the first song, everyone but Blink and the one guy who signed them had left the room.
Nice.
Now, let's look at the cover art. This one is pretty iconic. It's a black cow with a red stamp or like a brand of Blink-182 on its backside. And the image has become so iconic among fans, it symbolizes both rebellion against mainstream culture while also embracing an easygoing California lifestyle. Two sentiments that are central themes throughout much of Blink-182's early work, including this particular record itself.
Now, for a band that is all about dick and fart jokes, Dude Ranch has a surprising amount of depth, heart, and honest sincerity to it. And the fact that a lot of people couldn't look beyond the band's sophomore antics to see that other side of Blink-182, I have to say, is kind of pathetic.
Nice. You're starting our segue game off solid. Song number one is Pathetic.
The title is Pathetic. The song itself is pretty good.
You're right. Now, Mark, I think we'll talk a little bit about the music here and what we hear, but I think a lot of our discussion is going to have to be around the lyrics and the song meaning themselves because...
Because as a pop punk band, there's not necessarily a lot of far-reaching musical depth.
I know we call them pop punk, but that came to mean something else. I don't like that term as much for them.
They've had a lot of labels attached, and in addition to pop punk, they're also referred to as skate punk and mall punk. So if you have a better qualifier, I'm open to it.
I don't. I think the skate punk is what works better for me, though.
Okay.
Anyway, the song starts the album off on a very high note, and it does a great job of setting the tone for the rest of the album. It covers all the bases of what you're about to get from Dude Ranch. Everything kicks in immediately. We have a big, strong guitar, a solid bass line, and sharp, fast drums. The boys lay down some solid pop punk power without unnecessary flash for about the first 20 seconds, and then the vocals enter.
And the song features a nice back and forth of vocals from both Mark and the guitarist,
Tom.
And right out of the gate, the lyrics walk that tightrope of deep juvenile sincerity and adolescent self-actualization. The opening verse is, I know I'm pathetic. I knew when she said it. A loser, a bum's what she called me when I drove her home. There's no more waiting and sure, no more wasting. I've done all I can, but she still wants to be left alone. I think my favorite line of this one on the second verse where it says, although it's amusing, it's slightly confusing. I've done all I can, but her ego is still hard to move.
Oof.
Right? And then even the bit in the chorus, it goes on, you got to help me out, and I'll try not to argue. No one likes a dropout. Mistakes are hard to undo.
A While the lyrics of this one sound like it's another one of the many songs they have about failed relationships with girlfriends or failed attempts at making girls girlfriends, it originated in response to an argument Tom had with his mom when he was not doing so great in college. The title itself is a quote from that conversation. It was her response when he tried to tell her his dream was the band and college didn't matter.
Lucky for him, parents are idiots and kids are never wrong. And I gotta say, he probably could have had more pathetic ambitions in life.
Voyeur.
Because he could have decided that he wanted to be a rodeo circus clown or a car wash attendant or a professional voyeur or a podcast host.
Song two, Voyeur.
This album for me, just aside from it dropping in that summer before our sophomore year, it has a strong high school teen angst association, and not because I've ever been a peeping Tom,
but
rather because it was a critical part of my driver's ed experience.
You know, that's a lot better experience than my driver's ed experience was. My first time driving, I remember our driving ed instructor had me get on the highway after school on 290 in the rain. But that's not what made my driver's ed teacher the worst. What made him the worst was he would pull over, get out of the car, have us get out. It was me and an ex-girlfriend who took driver's ed together. We'd get out and stand around and he would ask us really stupid questions. And the one I remember that just irritated me to no end, he said, "What's the first thing you do when you get in a car?" And Mark, what would you answer?
Your mom.
That wasn't one of them that we guessed. We did all of them that you would think. Buckle your seatbelt, you adjust your mirror, you know, whatever. Close your door. Nope. He told us the first thing you do when you get in the car is sit down. But he did not tell us that until he was done smoking. And for us, the song that we listened to all the time was Closing Time by Semisonic.
To be fair, we didn't actually listen to any Blink 182 in the car.
Oh, it was just the same time?
I was in a driver's ed group, if you remember Jeremy Keanu.
I do remember Jeremy Keanu.
It was Jeremy, myself, and one other person. And Jeremy and I would sit in the back while the other person was driving, and we would sing Blink 182 songs. And this was one of the songs from the album that we both knew all the words to, and so this is one that we would sing just to mix it up.
Nice. Just randomly in the car to bug whoever else was in the car with you?
Right.
Okay.
People are driving in the front, we're just in the back, singing about looking through windows.
This is a song that conceptually has not aged well. Not that it wasn't questionable a quarter of a century ago, but to its credit, this is probably the catchiest song ever written about being a creep. Well, except for maybe creep. And when I say it didn't age well, it's got lines like, "I can't be too cool in a tree with my pants down. The air is cold and I've got splinters in my feet. She caught me once, but I don't think that she cares now. Unlike before, her view is now blocked by a leaf."
Yeah, this one, they get really, really deep.
But as you said, it is catchy.
I will say, I don't know why, but I think my favorite line from this is just the observation, "Her dad is big and I have never seen his face." I mean, he puts a lot of detail into the whole Peeping Tom experience.
Oh, damn it, Mark.
Track three. Damn it.
Hoppus told Billboard back in 98 that this song is about breaking up with someone, then seeing them all over town with someone else. He said, "It really hurts when you aren't the person feeling the love, but you have to act like it's cool to save face."
And speaking of Mark being hurt and needing to save face, to go along with what you mentioned earlier about Trombino pushing them vocally on the album, Hoppus has said that he originally wrote this one outside of his normal vocal range as a joke, which then backfired on him since he then had to try to hit that range and push his voice even further to get there because he was sick when it came to actually recording it. And all of that is why this one feels like there's such a rawness to the performance, because there is. It just might not necessarily be an emotional response to the subject matter, as one might assume.
Damn It was released as their lead single in the States, and it reached number 11 on Billboard's Modern Rock track chart and 26 on the Mainstream Rock track chart, and then 61 on the Hot 100. And when it blew up, it was everywhere, to the effect that it was in the top three most played songs of 1998 on rock stations across the country in cities like Seattle, San Francisco, Detroit, Boston, New York, Sacramento, Phoenix, and LA.
Now, this is one that I have a very vivid memory of hearing for the first time on the radio. Do you happen to recall your first listen, or was it one that just snuck up on you and then was suddenly everywhere?
It just kind of snuck up on me and was everywhere, but I will say I think this is my favorite song from Blink's bass player.
This is one that I know I was in the car with Peter, and we were driving down 1960 by the Fiesta, and I have no idea why I remember any of that or what we were doing, but this song came up, and we both stopped talking and turned the radio up, and we're just kind of like, what is this? And then, yeah, I heard it like 12 more times before going to bed that day. And I agree that this is one of Mark's stronger songs. And I don't know if there is a better response from any song that will run equal odds of either endearing yourself or pissing someone off indefinitely than by pulling out a, well, I guess this is growing up, in response to somebody else telling you a story.
You know, that was the original name of the song, but they decided to go with Damn It.
All one word, D-A-M-M-I-T, not Damn It. Damn it.
Yep. And they did that so that it would get more attention. I also learned that there's discussions on who wrote some of Blink's best riffs. And a few years ago, Hopus told fans on Twitch he wrote several of the riffs from the more catchy songs, not Tom. And as an aside, Mark, did you know this song was on Dawson's Creek, among other things?
No, because you only watched Dawson's Creek with Jacob and I was never invited.
Aw.
But that's okay because Jacob and I saw Blink without you. So it kind of balances out.
Kinda.
Although I think that was probably a self-imposed choice to not go to the show with me, like every other time you didn't go to a show with me.
That comes up on like every episode now.
Yeah, there were a lot of shows you missed out on.
I know.
But we saw Blink in Houston on October 15th of 1998 at Fitzgerald's. River Phoenix opened, and that was even pre them changing their name, as we mentioned on a prior episode. And it was one hell of a great show. And Fitz wasn't exactly small. It was a 500 cap room, so it was really nice to get to see Blink in a relatively intimate environment for them, because the next time that they came through town, they were playing the large arenas and charging four times as much for tickets in the cheap seats. And so I have never seen them since, but I am glad that I saw them when I did. And at the time, Jacob and I both agreed that you probably really would have enjoyed it.
As always, I'm a day late and a buck short.
Ooh, nice. But if only you could go back in time and tell your former self to be more fun and less boring.
Boo.
Track 4, Boring. Looking at the lyrics that you found, I guess that I have always had the chorus wrong on this one. Since reading it, it claims to say, no trust, all I got is lies, boring, all right. And all this time, I've been singing along thinking it's no trust, all guys lie. Which really still conveys the same message here.
Yeah, it does. Lyrically, this is a really short and simple song. If you don't count the repeat of the chorus, it's only 12 lines. And that chorus only has 9 words. But it's a solid song, and the economy of the lyrics is a great example of how the band is growing as songwriters, because they're still able to do so much with so little. And it's a song I didn't find the band talking about, like, at all. So I went and looked to see how often they played it, and they've only played it once, which is also the number of times that they've played The Cure's A Letter to Elise, Bryan Adams' Summer of 69, the song Happy Birthday, and My Milkshake Brings All the Boys to the Yard.
Damn right.
Okay, I was wondering if you were going to pick me up on that.
Against my better judgment.
Thank you. I appreciate you not leaving me hanging.
Following the end of this song, we have the album's first skit, which isn't super complicated. It's just the sound of someone making kissing noises for a few seconds, and then there's a horse whinny.
It's disturbing.
And I am not going to try to make a segue from that skit into the title of track 5.
And for that, we thank you, Mark.
Track 5 is the song Dick Lips.
So this was the third single, and it did not do well. The reason being, a lot of people argue that it didn't get as much radio play. It wasn't as popular as it could have been because Damn It was still ranking.
Now, I understand how people might be using that as an excuse for this one not getting a lot of radio play. But let's be honest, it's a good song. And if it wasn't called Dick Lips, it probably wouldn't have mattered how much radio play Damn It was also getting at the time.
This is true. And I don't think I have anything else to say about a title like that, Mark. The song's good. The song has nothing to do with the title whatsoever. The song's fun, but it's a juvenile song.
Yep.
Like quite literally, because Tom's singing about being a child. He says, I am a kid. I know not what I did, just having fun. Tom got a lot of lyrical mileage out of being a generally irresponsible youth. And I think we love him for that.
Yep. And while it was written by someone else in the band, Mark was the one who named it. And as he tells it, he says, the day that we recorded that song, I was calling everybody Dick Lips. At this point in the interview, Scott, who's in the background, chimes in and saying, week, because apparently he'd been doing it all week and not just that day. But Mark continues, I don't know why I started saying it, but then we had to write a song title down because we recorded the lyrics and the music for the song. And, you know, you can't just have an empty space on the thing with the thing, because otherwise it gets all confusing. And we had to name a song, and I said, let's name it Dick Lips. And then everybody just sat there and nobody said anything. So it just kind of went like that.
I also don't have a good segue for a made-up word. The next song, song six, is called Waggy. Tom, quote, made this word up while belching and wanted to title a song with it. This is the song that got stuck with that title.
So at least they're digging deep to find inspiration for these names.
They are.
This one, lyrically, I have to admit that I found the song far too relatable in high school.
Which part?
Pretty much all of it.
Okay.
Just the first verse, it starts off, watching your house shrink away in my rearview mirror as I drive away, wishing that I could take back all those words that meant nothing that I didn't say. I'm trying to be what you want me to be, but it's so damn hard to keep playing the part of the fool week after week. Oof. That one's tough.
That is tough.
Verse two continues, is this all going to be another time that we play this game? I've tried to convince you that things could be different, but somehow they end up the same. But what did you expect from me? What am I supposed to do? You say that you're starting to feel like you're getting lost. Well, I do too. You can hear the exasperation in this one and his lack of enthusiasm.
He is not enthused. Enthused. Song number seven. Fun fact, this is the longest intro on the album. The vocals don't come in until 55 seconds into the track, which is kind of an impressive feat since most of the tracks have the vocals kicking in within, you know, the first 10 to 20 seconds. Plus, this song is under 3 minutes, so a third of the song is just the intro.
I know you're a big fan of pointing out drug references in songs.
I am.
This is the first point on the album where they joke about smoking crack.
Yeah, crack is whack.
Indeed. We've talked about on prior songs how they dug deep within themselves to really find meaningful track names.
Yep.
And apparently this one was too much and they left it untitled.
On this track, the band really steps out of their comfort zone to try something new. Since lyrically it's about a boy liking a girl who probably doesn't like him back, you know, like that.
What? Isn't that every Blink 182 song that isn't about pooping your pants?
Yeah, well, I was trying to snazzy up the format to sound better than, here's another song Tom wrote because girls don't love him.
Fair.
Although that does bring up a solid point about how even if they're not stretching themselves very far in the themes they write about, they do a decent job of finding different approaches to say the same thing over and over in equally relatable ways. And that's probably the main reason people have responded to the band so well, except for Saves_the_day_girl, who, from our sponsor songmeanings.com back in 2002, said, I don't like too many Blink songs, but this one is really good. She quotes the first verse here and says, I think of a while ago we might have had it all, but I was so stupid then, you needed time to grow. But now, just as things change, as well my feelings do, in time things rearrange, I'm so sick of chasing you. That reminds me of me and my ex Sean.
So you're telling me that somebody whose username is Saves the Day Girl isn't a big enough Blink fan to be called Blink 182 Girl?
I don't think so.
Imagine that.
Yeah. This song also deals with like hurting others. He says, it's not a change of pace. This time I'll get it right. And then after that chorus, he goes into, you have your other friends. They were there when you cried. Didn't mean to hurt you then. Best friends just won't leave your side. So he's acknowledging maybe he's not the best.
Maybe, but you know what is the best?
What's the best, Mark?
The skit that ends this song. This is my favorite of Blink 182 skits.
Just all the screaming?
Well, it starts off with multiple women screaming.
Yep.
There's just all the, and then you hear a voice come in. What? It'll clear up. I promise. I got some ointment for it. The doctor says it's not infectious. It'll be gone in a week. And then there's a big sigh of relief from all the women who were just screaming.
Oh, that was your voicemail for a while. Actually, I shouldn't say voicemail. I should say that was the sound of your answering machine.
It was. Once I realized everyone was tired of hearing that clip I had from the Beastie Boys' Sabrosa, I switched it up to this. I was never one for traditional outgoing messages.
But I do fondly remember the smell of your apple shampoo in your hair, Mark.
Well, I think after we finish this episode, we need to have a serious discussion about why you are sniffing my hair. But track 9 is apple shampoo. Depending on your source, Some places list Apple Shampoo as the second single. Some will claim Damn It is the second single. Both are technically correct because when the album first came out, Apple Shampoo was released in Australia as the first Australian single, whereas Damn It was released as the first single in the States, and Apple Shampoo was then released after that as the second single.
So they're both correct.
They are both technically correct, which is the best kind of correct.
Did you really have Apple Shampoo?
No. So then maybe we need to have a serious discussion instead as to whose hair were you sniffing? Anyway, I really do love that skit between this song and the prior one. Like I said, it's possibly my favorite Blink skit. But I also very much love this song, in part because it goes against pop songwriting convention by not having a solid, discernible verse, chorus, verse structure.
Yep.
Although, unlike a lot of songs that try to do that, there are still definitely discernibly different musical parts, and the song shifts throughout to make it a dynamic ride. And there's also so many lines from this one that just floor me.
The lyrics are great. And Hoppus wrote this one about a failed relationship with Elise Rogers, who was the vocalist in the band Dancehall Crashers. And he's explained the title of the track saying, quote, "The girl that the song was written for used Apple Shampoo. And that's what I remember about her. She always smelled like Apple Shampoo. And that's why I named it Apple Shampoo, because it's about her. And it would have been really bad form to name the song Elise from Dancehall Crashers." When I read about them being sick, you can kind of hear that in his voice as he's straining his voice so hard. I think I noticed it most in that second chorus where he's like both getting tired of punk rock clubs and both playing in punk rock bands. You can really hear his voice straining.
You know, again, I don't know, but I have to wonder how much of that is due to illness and how much because this one is a very personal song.
It is.
So it could be more of the emotional strain, or it could just be a happy coincidence because of the vocal strain that makes it sound emotional. Just the opening verse here. "She didn't mean to deceive you, believe me, but sometimes the hardest part is conceiving. The good intentions that you had now only came to this. And although she saw the mark, the arrow missed." Good job with the wordplay of working your own name into the song, bud. It's also, despite being so upbeat, not the happiest of songs.
It's not happy at all. It's really sad.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking at the point a little further down in the song. He says, "It's awkward trying to make my move. I'll pretend that I'm fine, show up right on time, but I know I'll never be that cool. I never wanted to hold you back. I just wanted to hold on, but my chance is gone." And I think my favorite section of the song is, of course, equally depressing as the rest of it. But he goes on, "I know just where I stand, a boy trapped in the body of a man. I'll take what you're willing to give, and I'll teach myself to live with a walk-on part of a background shot from a movie I'm not in."
That's so emo, Mark.
It is.
Song 10, emo.
And track 10 was emo before it was cool to be emo.
The band made some interesting decisions on this album. Unlike the prior track, this one does have a solid verse, chorus, verse structure. But while Hoppus is taking the lead on vocals, Tom comes in and offers not exactly harmonies, but for lack of a better word, we'll say it's harmonies at points throughout the first verse to kind of accentuate the ending of certain lines. Then on the second verse, he does some of that, but takes it further to fully double complete stanzas. And yet, you might think the more obvious choice would be to accompany on the chorus, but he does absolutely none of that. Then, towards the end of the track, when Hoppus starts repeating, "She's better off sleeping on the floor," over and over and over, Tom, instead of adding harmonies, switches to a counter lead and just repeats, "Because she fell right off the bed."
And again, here, I'm not sure if it's a result of feeling the vocal strain while making the album, or if it's an actual deliberate choice, but there's a flatness in the vocal delivery on this one. With lines like, "One more time, you will laugh about it, and he'll never try to give you more. And I don't care, he is such a dick, treats you like you are a stupid whore. And it seems like things will never change. You go on, every cloud is in your way. And I know you feel empty all the time. You'll never listen to anything I say." And with the flatness of his delivery there, there's a seeming apathy that reflects the emotional exhaustion of those lyrics. It's just kind of a matter-of-fact approach, I think, to becoming exhausted at watching somebody else just make mistakes over and over again.
Yep, just like Josie.
Who's Josie?
I have no idea.
But track 11 is Josie.
It is. Track 11 is the song Josie. And Josie is not a real person, which is why we don't know who she is.
Well, we do know who she is, but she was not a real person.
Right. Josie's not a real person, but she's written by Hoppus about his idea of a perfect girlfriend, although it was loosely based on Elise Rogers, who he mentioned previously on Apple Shampoo, since that was also written about her. And while not a real person, Josie was the name of Elise's dog.
Now, Josie the song, not the dog, was the fourth and final single from Jude Ranch, and it did well enough as a single that they were able to get Alyssa Milano to be in the music video. And while it didn't chart in the States, it did hit number 31 in Australia. And fun fact, just for Tom, you, not the bassist, the single release of this contained two tracks that had been on Cheshire Cat, as well as the band's first foray into holiday music with the song I Won't Be Home for Christmas, which itself was reissued in 2001 as a holiday single that charted in Canada. And even though by then he hadn't been in the band for 3 years, it became the last single Blink released with Scott on drums.
Nice.
Yep. It was a Christmas miracle.
The things that he lists for a perfect girlfriend are not really top of my list. Out of the gate, he talks about how she drives him home when he's drunk. She doesn't get jealous when I hang out with the guys. She laughs at my dumb jokes when no one does. And she brings Mexican food from Sombrero just because.
Really? You don't want a girl to bring you Mexican food?
That's the one there. The rest of it, I'm not like, eh.
Well, I'll agree that your jokes are pretty dumb. But I will say at least he's being responsible enough to not be driving himself home when he's drunk.
That's just not something I've never really needed that.
I'm not saying I have either, but I'm just saying it's good that he's at least recognizing there's...
He's more of a responsible drinker than apparently Thomas.
But looking at least that second line, it makes me think about his prior girlfriend who made him leave the band that one time.
Yep.
And to go along with being smart enough to not drink and drive, he shows other moments of surprising maturity for the band in here with lines like, she's so smart and independent, I don't think she needs me quite half as much as I know I need her.
He's probably right.
But then he kind of ruins that in the next verse where he says, it doesn't seem to matter that I'm lacking in the bulge. So he goes back to just being immature.
The whole thing's self-deprecating.
Yeah.
He is a terrible boyfriend who somehow has a great girlfriend.
Well, I don't think it's necessary that he's a terrible boyfriend, but I think that anytime that you're in a relationship with somebody who is really good for you, I think you're constantly worried that you're not good enough and you're going to screw it up for any number of reasons. I think it's natural to start examining your own flaws in that situation.
Can't relate. I just feel like whoever I'm with is a pretty lucky person. And you said my jokes are bad.
No, I'm not laughing at the joke. I'm laughing at the fact that you actually believe that.
Oh, I don't. That's why it was a joke.
You're lucky your wife doesn't listen to this podcast. That's all I'm going to say.
Speaking of things my wife doesn't like, my wife is not a Star Wars fan and has not seen A New Hope.
Track 12, A New Hope.
Star Wars was Hoppus's favorite movie.
You know, that might be part of the reason why they liked Static Prevail so much, since that is the Jimmy album that had the song Episode 4.
Keep in mind, the 1997 theatrical re-release where George Lucas tried to ruin Episode 4 hit theaters around the time that Blink finished tracking the album. And at this point, Episode 1 was still 2.5 years away. So no one knew about Metachlorians or Anakin's feeling about sand or any of that. Heck, most people don't even know or care who Anakin was if you said his name. At the time, Star Wars was known, it was in the public consciousness as a thing that existed, but it wasn't socially acceptable to be into it like it is now. And it certainly wasn't the kind of thing that you could talk about, much less write songs about, to make yourself cooler. So this song was kind of a bold move for a band that was on the way up and trying to break through.
Yeah. And while he doesn't necessarily get super deep on it, I mean, it's not like he name drops Wilrow Hood or anyone like that, but he still mentions some staples like Han and Lando and Endor. And I think my favorite line is, even though I'm not as cool as Han, I still want to be your man. You're exactly the kind of Alderaanian that I need. But then he goes and he drops the ball by saying, I was hanging out in the cantina on Mos Eisley. And everyone knows that doesn't make any sense because everyone knows Mos Eisley is a spaceport city on the planet of Tatooine. So he could have been hanging out in Mos Eisley, but not on Mos Eisley since Mos Eisley is not its own planet.
Nerd.
Dork.
Geek.
Degenerate.
Nope.
Do you want to acknowledge track 13?
Track 13, Degenerate!
You said that with feeling.
I did.
This one is another one that we sang a lot during Driver's Ed, which going into Driver's Ed, I had logged a lot of time behind the wheel. So the main thing that I took away from that class was memorizing the chorus of the song.
We're doing another drug reference in the chorus of this song, a couple of them. We speak about hash and smoking a bong.
The chorus is... Don't like hash, don't like rap, kicked old Sally because she's fat. I'm a jerk, I'm a punk, took a shower because I stunk, smoked a bong, killed a cat, had my nuts attacked by rats, dad got nude, I wore a thong, for a hobby I make bombs.
That's disturbing.
All of which I just recited without looking at the lyrics. Swish. Like you said, there is more drug referencing in this chorus, and the song as a whole is the most juvenile, immature, fun song on the album.
Not saying a lot, given the title of other ones and some of the things they talk about.
This one is all about getting naked, getting arrested.
Cow tipping.
You know, all those normal, socially accepted behaviors that teenagers participate in.
Yes.
When everyone else is doing it.
The things we weren't dumb enough to write songs about.
Just going with the flow like lemmings.
14 Lemmings. This is an interesting one lyrically. It's got a nice poetic quality in the way that it combines random observations with emotions to build a nostalgic palette. And then it all flips in the final verse and turns bluntly mean.
Indeed.
This one's really well written.
It is. I always really enjoy the opening lines on this one. It says, a freight train to the right, feeling that sting of pride. It's messing with me. It's messing with you. He doesn't really say messing. All is fair in love and war until you say it isn't, but you're wrong. And so, yeah, like you mentioned there, there's seemingly random observations, but I think that it helps just establish the feeling of this one.
Yep. I like the chorus of this one a lot. It's so just this guttural feeling. Is it too much to ask for things to work out this time? I'm only asking for what is mine. I wanted everything. I got it. And now I'm going to throw it away. I'll throw it away.
Yeah.
The next ones, he goes into like self-inflicted hate. And I don't know. It's rough.
Yeah. And honestly, like I've always really liked that last verse for how just straightforward and unapologetic it is calling somebody out.
Yeah.
And because like the first couple of verses kind of are an ode to this friendship. And then in the last one, he goes into, you're going to drown in the mess you make, your self-inflicted hate. You turn your back on the friends you lose when they don't follow all your rules. But people are what they want to be. They're not lemmings to the sea. Maybe it's time you looked at yourself and stopped blaming life on someone else.
He's just saying what's out there without an I'm sorry anywhere in it. There's no apology.
Track 15, I'm sorry. And this one is easily the most dynamic song on the album, not just musically. I'd argue it also features the best vocal performance of any song on Dude Ranch that were sung by Blink's guitarist.
Yeah, I agree. It's a powerful song.
It's an interesting shift from his prior one, Degenerate, and just how different it is lyrically, thematically.
Yeah.
In addition to showcasing both the musical and vocal range, it also showcases his range as a songwriter.
You mean he can be mature?
Mostly.
I like it when they sing together on this one.
Yeah, that's one thing that we get on the first track, and then we don't necessarily get a lot of until the end. I mean, there's parts throughout the album where they are harmonizing, but on Pathetic and with this one, where they kind of bounce lines back and forth, I think is really a moment where Blink shines as a band.
And that wraps us up.
Or does it?
Dun, dun, dun.
Around 3:50, this song starts to fade out, and the solid stream of I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry goes away and is replaced by a feedback tone that fades in and sounds like a test of the emergency broadcast system. It's held for about 45 seconds, and then that fades out, and the album closes with one more super mature skit from the band. Which I might have ripped off at some point, either junior or senior year, for a theater class video project.
Do you sell the video?
I wish I did, but I don't.
Bummer.
But the skit here, you hear a sound like water pouring, and then you hear somebody vocalizing relief, like a, ah. And you kind of start to put together that maybe somebody's going to the bathroom. And that finishes up, you hear a zip, and then the person who was peeing starts talking to their doc. Like, come here, Rexy. Come here, boy.
Nope.
Come here.
Nope.
And
nope.
Then you hear a dog start drinking out of
the toilet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But in theater, we had I don't know if you remember, but in theater, we had that project where we were supposed to be filming testimonial videos.
Yeah.
I was in a group with Scott Krieger, and Scott got chosen to be the guy who looks in the camera and endorses the product or whatever the thing was. And so we did the same thing where Scott's talking to the camera and I'm sitting on top of the toilet tank, holding the camera down, kind of shooting up at his face as he's talking down into the camera. And somebody else was sitting there reaching between his legs with a pitcher of water, pouring it into the toilet while he's talking. And it was easily one of the best things that I did in high school theater without you.
That's disgusting.
Yeah, I'm sure it went over wonderfully with Candace.
I think by that point, she had just given up on both of us.
That was probably the kind of thing she came to expect.
Yeah, I think so.
So that wraps up Dude Ranch. And after this album dropped, they did a bunch more touring. And it was during all that touring that Scott got fired from the band.
It was. So they never came out fully and told the story of what happened, but there's enough pieces that we know that Scott was never fully satisfied with the band, having signed with a major label. A lot of punk bands he knew and liked were all signed to Epitaph, and he was dissatisfied Blink didn't go that route.
He also had what I've only ever seen referred to as a major personal loss, which from context clues, I'd guess is code for a death in the family. But that's just my personal speculation. And on top of all of that, like we mentioned earlier in the episode, he was young. At this point, he was only 19 years old. So he was young and wild and free and following in the wonderful footsteps of the example set by Tom DeLonge. He was drinking at a young age and he developed a drinking problem. And all of those other factors made the drinking worse to the point where he was given an ultimatum to go to rehab or quit the band. So Scott chose rehab, but for whatever reasons, he still got the boot.
Can you imagine? You agree to go to rehab and clean up and they still boot you from the band?
Since they've never come out and been fully clear with what the timeline is, I do know that kind of around the time that he was giving that ultimatum, there had been actual fistfights between him and other band members.
Yeah.
So it may have been one of those things where rehab was put on the table and then he got drunk and started punching. And then they're like, you know what? Rehab's not good enough. It's really hard to say.
And now he's a cop.
So being drunk and belligerent won't be a problem anymore. One thing I've been meaning to ask you on prior episodes, just because we cover so much ground on all these episodes with our research, was there anything that you came across in your research that you found interesting that maybe didn't naturally find its way into the bulk of what we've been discussing with this episode?
You know, I ended up spending a lot of time researching Tom DeLonge. I learned his favorite website is howtowipeyourbutt.com, and I looked it up, and it is literally a website about how to wipe your bottom.
Huh. The big thing that I learned is that Mark is 6'2", which I found interesting. Not that I've ever really thought about their height before, but I just feel like there's so many celebrities and famous people who are short that to discover that somebody's actually kind of tall is interesting. And beyond that, Tom's a freak because he's 6'4".
Yeah, none of them seem like they would be that tall.
No, I mean, I don't think I've ever seen them put next to like NBA players.
No.
Although I guess we have seen them running next to little people. But then again, I guess that would make anyone look tall. So I don't know.
Okay, you gonna wrap us up?
Yeah, before we get into our favorites from the album, I wanted to leave one final thought. It's something I came across in a comment section in a Reddit discussion about Dude Ranch. And in it, someone else managed to pretty much sum up my feelings about the album and the band perfectly, so I didn't have to. So thanks, user Jordan Duro. They say, Dude Ranch has remained my favorite Blink album ever over all these years. It's their last true-to-form, raw Blink album. Everything that followed felt more like a product than an authentic representation of who they are.
I like it.
Yeah, it's a bold claim, but it's true. This is right before they blew up, and when they did, their production jumped up a level, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but I agree completely with how he says that it felt much more like a product than anything that was authentic, up until they became high artists with Matt Skiba.
All right, now we come to my least favorite part of our episode, Mark.
What's that?
I have to figure out my ranking, and it always changes as I'm going through. I'm like, oh yeah, that is really good. You know yours?
I do. This one was mostly easy for me because I knew number two and number one. They've been number two and number one since the dawn of time.
I wonder if we have the same number two and number one.
But for number three, I'm going to pull a Tom and say that I have a 7-way tie.
I love it.
Not really, but it was really hard to pick what number three was.
That's where my change is coming into.
Right before you called me, literally seconds before, I decided to settle for I'm Sorry as number three. For some of the reasons that we mentioned, being the most dynamic song on the album, plus the addition of the vocal contributions from both singers.
Yeah.
They don't do that enough, and it was kind of up in the air between I'm Sorry and Pathetic and Dick Lips.
Okay.
But number two is Damn It.
Okay.
And number one is Apple Shampoo.
Okay. We landed on the same exact three, just in a different order.
Okay.
I'm Sorry was up there for me, along with Untitled.
Okay.
And Pathetic, just because I like the way it opens up. Those three were vying. But I think as we talked about the dynamic nature of I'm Sorry, and I went back and I thought about the nice harmony that we have, that one ended up winning out. And then number two for me is Apple Shampoo, and number one is Damn It.
Nice. I kind of expected that that was going to be your two and one in that order. Yeah.
I like when we align, but I think before we came here and talked through it, I think it probably would have been Untitled.
There's just a lot on here that's really good.
Yep.
I mean, even Waggy was a contender, and I kind of realized that I didn't want to necessarily pick only Mark tracks because there are some that Tom wrote that I do love.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, at least kind of showcases both, but I am not sorry about my picks.
Nope. I feel good about them.
Excellent. And I feel good about what we're going to be covering next episode.
Mark, what are we covering next episode?
Next episode, we will be covering Not a Surf's debut album, High Low.
And the namesake of our podcast.
Or is it? Tune in and find out. In the meantime, find us on social medias. Let us know what your favorite song from the album is, or what your favorite Blink-182 immature skit is, or your opinion on Tom being right about UFOs. Well, thanks for listening. This has been another episode of Once Every 2 Weeks.
Once Every 2 Weeks is a production of Burro Borracho Records.